This is Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman. County jails and state prisons may not seem that different looking from the outside, but for the people within the walls, living conditions in jails are often very different from what they might experience in state prisons. Christopher Blackwell is an incarcerated journalist. He recently wrote a New York Times op-ed about what he saw during roughly 2 weeks spent in Pierce County Jail. It was a short detour during a decades-long prison sentence. Blackwell is currently incarcerated at the Washington Corrections Center for Men, a state prison in Shelton, Washington. And he called us up from his cell.
So right now I'm connecting to the phone on a tablet, which we recently acquired at my prison about 3 months ago. We were switched over to Securus Technologies, and they actually provide us with a tablet that has a phone on it and an e-messaging system. So I'm actually sitting in my cell. I'm looking out the window at the birds that are landing on the grass right now and looking at the enormous amounts of razor wire and fences that are covering and surrounding the premise. And I am sitting at my desk right now and just kind of just waiting to have a conversation.
Yeah. And what is your cell like? How big is it? What's inside of it?
Well, not that big. They're about the size of a mid-sized walk-in closet. There's a bunk bed setting in there, and you know, I live with another individual. There's a small metal desk with a little metal stool, and then a few metal shelves, and then just the concrete floor and the concrete wall, and the few amenities that we're allowed to have in here, such as a TV and a couple of other small things. Lots of books.
And you published a powerful op-ed in the New York Times recently that called out conditions at the Pierce County Jail. Let's just set the scene. You're incarcerated at a state prison. How did you end up at Pierce County Jail, and how long were you there?
I ended up at the Pierce County Jail, one, because I'm from Tacoma, Washington. I grew up in the hilltop area of Tacoma, and I was there because I have a Blake charge on my judgment and sentence, and I was going back to be resentenced because of that, because of the state versus Blake and the resentencing that were taking place due to that. So I was transferred back after 20 years in the state prison system back to the county jail to be resentenced, which I ultimately did not get.
So it was a drug-related charge that was governed under that Blake decision.
Right. It was actually the first charge I had ever experienced. It was when I was 12 years old for possession of marijuana. And when I had been stopped and frisked with a friend coming home from school, and we had a little bit of marijuana on us. And ironically, I've been in the system since that moment in my life, and I'm 42 years old now. So, I mean, quite a ride.
Yeah. So folks will understand you have been incarcerated for a charge. You pleaded guilty to robbery and murder when you were 22 years old. Like you said, you're now 42, and you're about halfway through a 45-year sentence. I assume that you've seen a number of different carceral institutions in your time. What was your initial impression of Pierce County Jail when you arrived?
It was interesting. Of course, I was there when I first was charged with my crime and spent quite a bit of time there as I was working through the court system. But, you know, I was interested at the fact that after all these years, after almost two decades, the system hadn't changed, the building hadn't changed, it had actually gotten worse. Just the amount of decomposing parts of the building that are now still like trying to, you know, remain retention as they continue to place people inside these buildings was incredibly mind-blowing, to say the least. You know, just the population and the drug epidemics and stuff that we're obviously seeing, that you guys are seeing out there play out in society, was, you know, was a strong force in there. There was a lot of people detoxing from drugs and fentanyl and other things that we're seeing out in society today that you know, are a travesty. And just the lack of help, right? The lack of support that people were getting, you know, the mental health, the individuals that were suffering from severe mental health conditions that were placed in the general population and given little to no help and support. It's just really eye-opening to me that at this point in our lives, and you know, in 2023, that's how we were treating people.
One of the major problems you highlight in the New York Times is the treatment of people with mental illness and disabilities who are in jail. Tell me about your roommate, William Starkovich, and what he experienced. And we should note that William did give you permission to tell his story in the New York Times.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, when I first got in there, you know, William was in a really bad place. He hadn't had anyone to really help him process some of the issues that he'd been suffering from. And being his first time incarcerated at the age of 35, you know, from a lapse, an episode that he had had, you know, with an altercation with his family, he was still a bit confused. He was trying to figure out what had happened. He was trying to process things. He suffers from multiple disorders, and he wasn't getting the attention that he needed, you know. So thankfully, I had been incarcerated for some time, and I've done a lot of work. I've done a lot of classes and a lot of restorative justice work and stuff like that, you know, and just general education. So I was able to use a lot of those tools that I built and developed over the years to kind of just help William process what he's going through and where he's at and like kind of address some of his needs. And it, you know, it was just hard to watch an individual that was suffering on that level that had never been introduced to the carceral state and system to have to survive in such a volatile and just aggressive environment and just the way that he was taken advantage of, and that the people that were meant to protect him were doing little to anything, you know. And in some scenarios, when he was trying to voice his fear and being reluctant to like be placed in some of these environments, you know, instead of protecting him, like he was also abused by the people that were supposed to protect him. So, you know, it was disheartening to see.
Starkovich, you write, has bipolar disorder. He's on the autism spectrum. What happened when guards called a code blue on Starkovich? What was going on and what occurred?
Well, so I didn't actually witness it. This was accounts and from paperwork that Starkovich had showed me. But, you know, I know what a code blue is because I've seen them happen, you know, dozens and dozens of times, more times than I can even count in my incarceration. And it's a full-on assault and attack. And that's what happened to Starkovich when he refused to go into a unit because he was scared for his own safety and repeatedly asked for mental health support and to be placed in a mental health unit, which they do actually have in the jail, you know, and they refused to do that. He was assaulted and attacked. He was, you know, taken to the ground by multiple guards. He was, you know, had pressure put on his body in multiple places. He was tased. He was attacked like he was in an all-out assault against him. And anybody that, you know, has ever met Starkovich would have a hard time believing that he would take on a large group of men, you know, in, you know, full riot gear and all kinds of tactical tools meant to cause harm. So, you know, their claim of even that is a little far-fetched for me to believe.
Is the treatment of somebody with mental health issues and, you know, potentially disabilities, is it significantly different in jail than it is in state prison?
To a point. I mean, I think that we're suffering from a lot of that in state prisons as well. In jails, definitely people are pretty much just all placed in the same areas. It's basically your crime that decides where you go and your custody level, and that's just how you're placed. And they really could care less any other way. And in prison, you know, I think there's a little bit more mental health support that might be happening. But as well, like, prisons are not equipped to hold people with mental illnesses. They don't have the proper treatments. They're often just given medications to be zombified, or they're talked to, and all this stuff is placed in a file and eventually, you know, obviously can be used against them. They too are placed in general populations a lot of the time. And, you know, if it wasn't for some of us that have been around a long time to kind of help them navigate and make sure that they were safe, you know, who knows what could happen to an individual that's at that vulnerable of a state.
You write in the New York Times that many people in prisons are trying to better themselves. For the most part, people in jail are just trying to survive. Can you give us some examples of what is available to do in prisons that's not available in jail?
I know in Washington state, we have a lot more programming in prisons. I know across the country, there are some county jails that do offer programming and stuff like that. Ours doesn't offer any. They were not even offering religious services when I was there. The claim was that it was due to COVID, but this wasn't that long ago. And I think we're in the end of the COVID pandemic. And we kind of knew that like things were opening back up and they had been opened up far longer in society than they have inside county jails and in prisons. You know, we're still suffering from some of these conditions and restrictions. But I think in prisons, there's an offer for higher education. You know, there's some self-help classes. There's some treatment classes. I wouldn't say they're all the best, and I wouldn't say they're functioning at, you know, a high level. But, you know, there is something. And what there really is in prison is there's a lot of people that have been in prison for a long time that are mentors to the younger people that really work with people because, you know, we see it as our debt that's owed to society that we mentor and support people on a path to change so they don't continue to cause harm or continue to stay in environments like this for decades.
Let's talk about food in jail. First off, the meals that are provided to folks in jail. How does the quality and variety of what is available differ from jail to prison food?
Well, first, we might want to try to understand if what is given to you in county jail is even food. I would question if that was even food. A lot of the time outside of the bread, most of the things were pretty unrecognizable and were extremely poor quality. And, you know, when they say seasoned, I think they said they season their food and stuff like that. I would call it they dump quite a bit of salt into their food and consider that seasoning. But the food is such low quantities and quality that it's not sustainable for a person to, one, even want to eat it, but two, to be nutritiously sustained in the sense of having the proper amount of vegetables and things like that. I never were we given a piece of fruit in the 2 weeks that I was there. And the vegetables were on a very low level. And pretty much everything else came in the form of mush or some kind of weird patty.
And so that means in jail, I mean, in prison as well, but especially in jail with such little food and low quality, you're going to turn to the commissary. What is jail commissary like? And can you compare that to what is available in a prison commissary?
Right. And even to, like, you know, just going back a little bit too, thinking about, like, all the food in jail and prisons is processed. And we know about what eating processed foods on a continued basis can do to one's overall health. You know, so that leads us into buying things off the commissary as well, which there too, you're not getting foods that are absolutely all that much better for you. But it's the prices that is the difference between jails and prisons. They pretty much have a lot of the same items on their commissary list. But take, for instance, a case of Top Ramen was almost $30 in the jail. You know, this is something that costs a little over $6 on Amazon and costs only $8 in prison. A bag of 3 ounce bag of coffee that's, you know, $3 in prison was, you know, a 3.5 ounce bag of coffee in county jail was like $13.50. The same bag of dried refried beans that are in prison for $1.50 were $5 in the county jail. You know, and the list just kind of went on and on and on. And this was for everything. You can't buy a spoon on a certain level in the county jail. So people are eating the food that they pay these exceptional prices with their hands because there is nothing else, no other utensil to eat these items, you know. So it was just interesting to see why the same items could be marked up at such an extortionary rate compared to what they are in prison, because obviously in prison they're still making a profit because the store is ran by correctional industries, which if they didn't generate a profit, they wouldn't be able to pay their staff to continue having that function. So what makes the price have to jump so high in county jail? And is that because that's all they have and it's a forced monopoly to where you have no other place to obtain these items?
Mm-hmm. And you write also that phone calls were four times as expensive for a 20-minute call in county jail than they are in Washington State Prison. So there's just a lot of economic pressures also that are different in jail.
And that's from the same exact company, right? So we're paying four times the amount of money to the same exact company. Why can the same company charge four times the amount for a call from prison to a county jail? And the only rational thing is that the kickbacks the county's getting that the jail is getting for those calls, because that's usually how the contracts work with prisons and jails, is they write into their contract what they get. So it's usually that the prisons and jails are getting an exceptional amount of that contract, sometimes up to 80 or 90%.
I just want to kind of zoom out and talk about who is in jail and who is experiencing these conditions that you witnessed in Pierce County. You point out that most people sitting in jail have not been convicted of anything yet. They are pre-trial, and they're sitting there, except in very rare cases of community safety issues. They're sitting there because they can't afford bail. As of January 1st, Illinois was supposed to be the first state to totally eliminate cash bail, but that law is now being reviewed by the state Supreme Court. Other places like California have tried to eliminate cash bail, but efforts to replace it with an equitable alternative have stalled. So for now, cash bail is the system that we have. What should our listeners know about who ends up sitting in jail because of a lack of funds to make bail?
I mean, it's easy. Impoverished communities, right? And these are communities that are mostly Black and brown communities. And these are the individuals that cannot afford the bail. You know, a lot of the times, even when you're using a bail bonds and a cash bail, if you have a $50,000 bail, which you can easily acquire for not that crazy of a crime, what some would deem violent, you know, even, you would have to pay a $5,000 a bond on that bail and have something to put down as credit for the $45,000 that you can't pay. So, you know, how many families are living check to check? How many families can't afford to come up with $5,000 and don't have $5,000 in the bank? Quite a bit. If we look at numbers around the U.S., there's not many people that can afford that from these communities. So this is basically, having cash bail is an attack on the poor, right? An attack on impoverished communities of color. And that's what it's always been. And when we have that, you know, oftentimes when you put people in those environments and they can't afford these things to survive anyway, you know, they're going into debt to pay for phone calls, to put money on their loved ones' commissary accounts and things like that. You know, so they can actually eat and survive in these environments in even the smallest ways. So, I mean, it's easy, right? We know who we're attacking. We know what the attack is on, because anybody that comes from the middle class or above, you know, they're not suffering from that. They can easily pay $5,000 to get out of jail on a $50,000 bond.
What happens to a person when they're subjected to the kind of treatment that you saw in county jail and to, you know, a wider extent to the treatment that happens in state and federal prisons? What happens to a person under those conditions?
I mean, people can be jaded, right? You know, often like when people come and they are, you know, connected to the carceral system, you know, and the state of it, is people are often victims themselves. You know, we know that in these communities, in our impoverished communities, that people are often victimized because they're very dangerous environments. You know, people are struggling to survive opposed to actually thrive as human beings. So when you come to a system that continues to oppress and harm you even more, you know, we also know the outcome of that. Hurt people hurt people. So when we put people in those types of environments, and then we compress that and we exacerbate that, and then we release people back on the streets without actually addressing the reasons that probably led them to prison in the first place, which there's always a reason, you know, poverty, why people steal, or abuse, why people harm, you know, things like that. If we were to address those, get people to be accountable around the harm they cause so they can understand that harm, and then place them back into the community with the resources needed so that doesn't continue to happen, we break that cycle. But if we just arbitrarily warehouse people and place them in an environment that's just as toxic, just as bad, you know, sometimes even more violent, then it's a no-brainer that people are going to get out. And the cycle of trauma, the cycle of abuse, cycle of violence, it continues. We see it. We always hear people say that we need to get tougher on crime. we've been getting tough on crime for decades, and we continue getting tough on crime, and it's not working. We have high murder rates. We have high violence levels, and they don't seem to be getting any better. So obviously getting tougher on crime and coming up with these exceptionally high arbitrary numbers for prison sentences isn't working. We need to invest, rehabilitate, work to get people accountable, and look at more transformative justice and restorative justice practices.
I can feel people in the audience saying, okay, Chris, but you committed a serious crime. You took a life, and prison and jail and this system is not supposed to be fun. It's supposed to be punishment. What is your message to somebody who has that reaction to hearing what you're saying?
Well, I mean, one, absolutely, I need to be accountable for the harm I caused. And I work every day to do that. That is one of the most important things that I can do in my life, is work towards paying that, like I said, paying that debt to society. So when you pay that debt, though, that debt comes with, what are you doing for society? Not just sitting in a prison rotting away, right? And we can't change the things that we've done in the past. Those things happen, and there's circumstances to those things. But again, we just have to be accountable to those things, right? So, I mean, when we work towards accountability, that is actually how we become with a more safer society as a in general. And I think that's what we want to work towards. So, you know, when people think about just punishment, if we just lead with punishment all the time, 97% of people come home from prison from their sentences, right? So they're guaranteed coming home. So who do we want to release? Do we want to release people that are going to be safer in society?
Yeah. Can you tell me more about the work that your nonprofit, Looking to Justice, focuses on?
So me and my wife, Dr. Chelsea Moore, created Look to Justice because we wanted to work on, how do we help people? How do we help people understand the system from impoverished communities? And how do we get to a better place, right? So we get to a better place if people understand how to participate in them better, right? So we wanted to find a way to teach people how to fish, not give them a fish. So what we did is we created an organization that allows us to do civic education inside prisons and on the community, out in the community, so we can start to help the people that are the most impacted learn how to work and navigate the system.
And how can folks learn more about your work? And I mean, of course, you're a writer and a journalist, and you are published in many places. Any other way you want folks to learn more about your work and your coverage of issues from inside of the prison system?
So folks can definitely go to our organization website, looktojustice.org, look the number 2 and then justice.org, and they can hear more about what we're doing. We hold a bunch of community events where we rally in community and try to spend time. We have barbecues, a lot of family-friendly events and things like that. And then also they can follow me at Chris W. Blackwell on Twitter, and they can always see about the things I'm writing about and what we're working on in the community and trying to work towards.
Chris, just to give folks an idea, what is the thing that kind of keeps you sane, for lack of a better word, while you are serving your sentence? What are the things that you focus on during your week that, you know, keep you, your mental health in check?
I mean, it's simple, doing the work, you know, doing the work, being supported by amazing people in the community, you know, being supported by my incredible wife, Chelsea, and, you know, my family, and, you know, and all the community members that, you know, are formerly incarcerated out there that have gotten out, that are now reaching back to do this incredible work to support the voices inside and get people prepared and ready to come outside to do the work that they're doing out there to make our community safer. You know, being a part of this network and this small committee of tight-knit individuals that, you know, really care about our communities, that, you know, have grown and become accountable and learned and transformed and, you know, getting ready to come out there and be a transformer in my own community.
What are the number one policy changes that you would like elected officials and voters in their own communities to be pushing for?
Retroactivity is the number one thing. Often we change policies. Like this year, a large group of us have been working, and it was led from the inside to pass House Bill 1324 that made where Washington State cannot use juvenile convictions and adjudications and adult sentencings anymore. But while we pass this incredibly important law that doesn't target our children and allow children to have crimes stacked against them so they can be given exceptional sentence in the adult courts, we didn't make it retroactive. We left everybody behind. All the people that, while the state recognized and our legislators did a great job of recognizing this harm that's been caused and is being caused, they refused to go back and do this for the kids and the individuals that were targeted for decades, you know, that we recognize things like the brain science, you know, that's being recognized, and the neuroscientists at Harvard and Yale and all these fancy colleges, you know, that we would 100% listen to their advice on so many countless levels, but yet we refuse to implement laws that would actually follow the science that they're giving us, right? That individuals under the age of 25 can't fully think about what we can understand right from wrong, but the cognitive part of our brain can't understand the ramifications of that long-term harm, right? Of what it's caused to others, what it'll cause to ourselves, right? So setting up things like that so we can pass laws so we can help individuals that are in these scenarios and stuff like this and follow that kind of science, right? Evidence-based and science-based legislation, that would be a good path forward.
Is there anything else you want to leave folks with before we go? Any final thoughts about what your experience was like in Pierce County Jail or the wider issue of jail and prison conditions nationwide?
We can easily just want to place people that cause harm inside a box and forget about them and think that that's solving our problems and that the punishment is enough and that that's going to deter people. It's clear punishment don't deter people from causing violent crimes or committing serious harms in our communities. We have to invest in our communities. We have to learn about this stuff. We have to see what's going on. We cannot continue to let things like this sit in the shadows and the dark and just accept what's going on as a blanket to just kind of mask all the stuff that we're dealing with in society that we don't want to really deal with. You know, if we truly want safer communities, that means we have to put in the work, we have to invest, we have to educate ourselves. You know, and I would just encourage everybody to take the time to think more and learn more around these areas, because when you do, you'll start to see that there's human beings that are incarcerated, and that if we help human beings that are incarcerated, then they won't cause harm. They won't come out and be a drawback to society. You know, they will actually come back and be contributing members. So, and we should never want to create another and stigmatize. We should only work towards a healthy, you know, healing and loving society.
Christopher Blackwell is an incarcerated journalist and co-founder of the nonprofit Look to Justice. And 2 is a numeral 2. Thank you so much, Chris, for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Libby.
That's incarcerated journalist Christopher Blackwell. We did reach out to Pierce County to respond to Blackwell's specific comments about jail food and the treatment of his cellmate, William Starkovich. A spokesperson with the Sheriff's Department, which is the direct supervising agency for the county's jail, replied that the department did not wish to participate in today's segment. The spokesperson said that the Pierce County Sheriff's Department will send a written response later this week, and we will share that response with you as soon as we receive it. Thanks for listening to Soundside. And hey, this show is only possible because listeners support us. If you are able to give right now, check out the show notes for a link to donate. And don't forget, you can listen live on KUOW 94.9 FM Seattle at noon and 8 p.m. Monday through Thursday, or anytime online at KUOW.org.